So we're going to talk a little bit about Egypt, and I have one of the preeminent experts on Egypt coming on the show to chat with us a little bit. I have Raymond Stock. Now, he's a Shilman Ginsberg Writing Fellow at the Middle East Forum. He's a former visiting assistant professor of Arabic and Middle East Studies at Drew University and Guggenheim Fellow with a Ph.D. in Near Eastern Languages and Civilization from the University of Pennsylvania. He was deported from Egypt after 20 years of residence by the Mubarak regime in 2010 for an article he published in Foreign Policy magazine. He is writing a brief biography of Egyptian Nobel laureate in literature, Naguib Mahfouz, and I apologize if I mispronounced his name, and seven of whose books he translated. And so he's really into this Egyptian culture. He's also commented on Middle East events as well as Mahfouz on the BBC, CBC, CNN, Fox News Channel, The John Batchelor Show, The Jim Bohannon Show, Steel on Steel, hosted by John Loeffler on the Information Radio USA Network, and elsewhere, in addition to extensive citation and print journalists such as Thomas Friedman of The New York Times, Barry Rubin of PJ Media, Lucette Lagnado of the Wall Street Journal, and many, many more. So he's a well-respected expert on Egypt. Actually, I find it quite interesting. He lived there for about 20 years until he was ultimately deported by the Mubarak regime. So why don't we go to the phones right now? Let's talk to Dr. Raymond Stock and find out what's going on in Egypt and what the future might hold for us in that region. So let's go to the phones right now. Well, Dr. Stock, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate you taking some time to chat with us, and welcome on air here on the Olympic Peninsula.
Well, thanks very much, Mike. I appreciate being here.
Thanks for the invitation. Yeah. So, obviously having you on to talk a little bit about Egypt and what's going on today, but as I introduced you to the listeners out there with your bio, I found it interesting that you had lived in Egypt for about 20 years and were ultimately deported by President Mubarak at the time. Can you tell us about that, why that happened, and what it was like living there before you were deported?
Sure. I was there for 20 years, mainly doing research on a biography of Naguib Mahfouz, a 1988 Nobel Prize winner in literature, who was from Egypt, for Farrar, Straus & Giroux Publishers in New York. And I was also doing my PhD, which was basically involved research on him as well, for my dissertation on his ancient Egyptian novels and short stories from the University of Pennsylvania. So I was there for a very long time, for basically 20 years, as you said. And I was ultimately deported, not while I was still living there. I actually got a job in 2010, in August of 2010, to teach at Drew University for a year. But in December of that year, of 2010, I chose to come back. I was denied entry and deported and sent back to Newark because I had written in 2009 an article very critical of the candidacy of the cultural minister of Egypt under Hosni Mubarak, Farouk Hosni, who was making anti-Semitic statements and who had a very anti-Israeli policy in the cultural sphere in Egypt, making it impossible for any cultural figures from Israel to have contact with Egyptians and vice versa, their Egyptian counterparts, and vice versa. So I thought that was a very bad record for someone who wanted to become head of the organization in charge of preserving and protecting the world's cultural heritage. So I wrote a piece about that in Foreign Policy magazine, published in August of 2009, pretty close to the election, which was in September of that year, for the head of UNESCO in Paris. And my article may have played a role, perhaps a significant role, in his defeat, though he was the expected winner by far before that.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's
That's why they didn't want me back in.
All right. Well, good for us then. You're back here. And so while you were living there, I mean, you were there for such a long time, and it wasn't that long ago that you were actually deported and not welcome back. Were there indications even back then that trouble was a brewing, so to speak, that we might be reaching this point that we're at today?
Going back how far? Well, I mean, there were indications before I left Egypt in 2010 that Mubarak himself was in trouble, and that there would probably be a very big, could possibly be a revolt against him when he had the next election, which was scheduled for September 2011 in which he was expected to eventually hand over after the routine win he was expected to get. He was expected to hand over rule to his son, who was not popular neither with the public nor with the military, which is the actual backbone of the regime, has been since 1952, because he was not a military member. So, unlike his father, who was an Air Force general.
Okay.
So, it was obvious that things, and the economy, even though it was booming, they couldn't keep up with the population boom itself, and there was a lot of muttering and discontent and rumblings, and you expected something to blow up at some point. But it happened sooner than anyone expected, and that was in January of 2011, after what happened in Tunisia, which was the sudden overthrow of Zine al-Abidine bin Ali, who had been ruling that country for 23 years in a popular uprising sparked by the self-immolation of a fruit and vegetable vendor in the country. And suddenly it was like this symbolic moment of, like straw that broke the camel's back over there for the people and the conditions they've been living under.
It was basically basically the start of the Arab Spring, right? Which
exactly, so it was so-called Arab Spring.
The so-called Arab Spring. This doesn't really seem spring-like where we're at now, though.
Well, it never really was a spring. First of all, it happened in winter. and it was basically not the sort of liberal democratic surge that everyone liked to think it was. It was that the people in the West particularly projected onto it, because there were a number of sort of liberal-sounding youth that were very active in the forefront of it, especially through the social media. But in fact, the majority of the bodies and even maybe the main impetus for the whole thing ultimately had come from the Islamists, who were far more numerous and far better organized and better funded. And they quickly seized control of all these movements.
Right. So where are we now in Egypt? I mean, you see the news, I mean, whether it's on television or you read it in print or the radio, whatever it might be, you see the news, you hear the news, and it looks like it's just chaos over there right now.
The impression of chaos is greater than the reality. You know, I'm in touch with people in Egypt all the time, and there was a great deal of violence in a few areas, and there continues to be violence in a number of areas in Egypt. But it was never the overwhelming sense of chaos that it appeared to be outside. There were very violent clashes, and they were by no means a massacre or a slaughter,
okay,
as portrayed in the Western media or international media. It was, in fact, a clash between two armed camps. The demonstrators in favor of President Morsi, who had been deposed by the military after the largest demonstrations in human history, had demanded his removal because he'd become a dictator. He was no longer a democratic ruler. Elections or no elections, and even his election is suspect. The army was responding to those demonstrations and removing him on July 3rd, and then you had the Muslim Brotherhood itself, which was for 84 years an underground organization that was secretly plotting revolution, and which, when it got in power through these fortuitous circumstances and the so-called Arab Spring, decided it would never leave power and began to rapidly change the institutions of the country so that they were no longer the traditional semi-independent institutions they were before, like the judiciary, and they even tried to change the military, which is itself full of Islamists. And the press and every other aspect of life in Egypt was being rapidly Islamistized, as I call it. They were not just Islamicizing, they were Islamistizing. They were turning it all into turning all the institutions into instruments of the Islamist state, the political Islamic state. And that's why they were overthrown.
Okay.
And, so the chaos is really largely in the relations between our country and Egypt.
I got you. So if it's not quite how, and it doesn't surprise me in the least bit that it's not quite how it's being portrayed in the news media over here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that doesn't surprise me at all, and hopefully it doesn't surprise most of my listeners. What is the relationship between the U.S. and Egypt right now, and should the U.S. be taking sides? Is there a side that the U.S. should take, or is it best just to stay out of it? Do you have any thoughts on those?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, before I go answer that question, I do want to answer that question very much, but I wanted to say one thing about the violence. There is ongoing violence all over the country against Christians.
Okay.
Yeah, so but in terms of the army fighting the Muslim Brotherhood, it's at a very low level right now. But in terms of the Muslim Brotherhood attacking others, it's still at a very high level.
In fact, I just read...
That's scattered all over the country. And also in the Sinai, there's an ongoing war that's been going on for some time that has increased since Morsi was overthrown, between the militants that are there to attack Israel, which were helped by Morsi, and other al-Qaeda elements that he also helped. He was aligned with al-Qaeda.
Okay.
And the Egyptian government. And the Israelis are also helping the Egyptian government now to regain control of Sinai. But in terms of your question about our relationship, America's relationship with Egypt, we have made every mistake in the book. First of all, it was the United States that actually promoted the Muslim Brotherhood above all other parties. When we were the outside party, outside power that was able to sort of help shape the events in the country, because we have the strongest international relationship with Egypt, through its military mainly. We've been giving them $1.6 billion in aid for recent years, and before that, it was even a greater amount of aid because of the relationship between us and the Israelis and the Egyptians over the peace treaty. And during Morsi's time in power, when he was already behaving like an Islamist dictator, more and more ramping up this tendency to consolidate the Muslim Brotherhood's power and to abuse and imprison and intimidate opponents and to tolerate, if not encourage, the attacks on the Christians that were going on, et cetera, et cetera. Our president remained completely silent and he didn't criticize them at all. Instead, he offered them more money. And when apparently two-thirds to three-quarters of the Egyptian public rose up against the Muslim Brotherhood in the end, we issued, you know, our government, our president issued statements critical of the military for taking action against this group. Even though he was, Obama was very careful, to his credit so far, he has not yet cut the aid. In terms of the public relations, he's blown it because he's still been very critical of them, and without being as critical of the Muslim Brotherhood, he should be more critical of the Muslim Brotherhood and less critical of the military. And it's because of his previous open support of the Muslim Brotherhood, the fact that our NGOs during the transitional period, before the elections that eventually put him in power, our NGOs, which were being funded by the government, were only helping the Islamists to win elections. The fact that he spoke in June 4, 2009, to start this whole process, really, at Cairo University, addressing this famous speech to the Muslim world, at that time he invited the Muslim Brotherhood's leaders, who were then banned. The group was banned under Mubarak. He invited them to come in the public to sit in the front row to hear him speak, which effectively excluded his official host, which is President Mubarak,
right,
our friend and ally, somebody he did call his personal friend. So he was saying to them, you're the future. And that became a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Wow.
And everyone knows this in Egypt.
That's...
So they're very mad for sticking to their ally, the Muslim Brotherhood, and not with the Egyptian people.
So we've made every mistake in the book. Sounds like we've lacked leadership and vision there. But what can we do now, or what should we do now?
Well, we should reverse the rhetoric. We should, I don't mind them, they should in fact be critical of any excessive use of violence. But they should also point out that this problem really began with the Muslim Brotherhood, not with the military. But the military is trying to set right the problem. That the Muslim Brotherhood, they should acknowledge, is an organization that is an international terrorist group. They should label it as such. Its Palestinian branch, Hamas, is labeled by our government as a terrorist group. And they have, in fact, been cooperating with Hamas in power, and since they've left power. So we should be focusing our statements on that. We should be acknowledge that they have been working with other terrorist groups, the Muslim Brotherhood has, including al-Qaeda. In fact, Morsi was working with Muhammad al-Zawahiri, who was the brother of Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda. And it will also be demanded the release of the blind sheikh, Omar Abdurrahman, who was the person who had plotted the original bombing of the Trade Center in New York, the World Trade Center in 1993, and other plots in New York City to blow up landmarks. And he's an al-Qaeda operative. So you can see where the man's loyalties lie. And we were actually giving this man F-16s and lots of military aid and 200 Abrams tanks. And that was all proceeding until Morsi was overthrown. And then Obama decided to cut off the F-16s that were still being delivered and to threaten to cut off the rest of the aid and to cancel our joint military exercises, the Bright Star exercises that were scheduled for September. So he should undo all those things. He should undo the canceling of the F-16s, undo the canceling of the joint military exercises, and state is unequivocal support for what the military is trying to do, with the exception of, you know, any necessary warning about excessive violence. But the military is not able to be surgically precise in its violence. It's not a police force. And this is a war, not a normal police action, because the Muslim Brotherhood is armed. It's an armed terrorist militia, which is attacking them.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of work to do, and this situation in the Middle East and Egypt isn't going to come to a conclusion, a peaceful conclusion anyways, anytime in the near future.
Well, there's one hopeful sign, and that is the Muslim Brotherhood is unable right now to rally as many people to its side as it had been. They were getting, you know, they had, in fact, many, many thousands of people in those squares camped out, those two squares that they were cleared in military action last week. And it's caused so much uproar in our media. And which they failed to understand. Well, they can't understand why we would be upset about removing people who were kidnapping passersby, killing informants and burying them in mass graves, suspected informants, and then their, you know, encampments. And, firing at the police and building up arms to attack the police and attacking churches and Christians and decapitating priests and all sorts of things. Why we would be upset that they tried to break those groups up, they can't understand. So, and that wasn't being reported properly in America either. So, I really think that I think I've lost part of your last question.
That's okay. We're about out of time anyways. And
okay.
I just really want to thank you for coming on and kind of bringing us up to date and up to speed and shedding some light on what's going on over in Egypt. It sounds like a highly complicated situation and one that we could probably spend hours talking about. But in the brief time I had, I really thank you.
Well, you're most welcome. And I hope we can do some more.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks.
All right, so that was Dr. Stock, Raymond Stock, and he's one of the preeminent experts in Egypt. He lived over there for about 20 years before being deported by former President Mubarak, talking about what's going on in the Middle East. And interestingly, but not surprisingly, news isn't being reported quite as accurately as it should be from what's going on in Egypt. He also said that we've made every mistake in the book, particularly with this current administration, need to remove the rhetoric and identify the Muslim Brotherhood as the terrorist group it is and start undoing some of the statements and policies of the past and working towards a better future. With that, we're out of time. We need to take a break. I'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to In the Booth. I'm your host, Michael Howe.